Listen now to the Gospel of Jesus Christ according to Luke. Then he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. They said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" He said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Doctor, cure yourself.' And you will say, 'Do hear also in your hometown the things that we have heard you did at Capernaum.' And he said, 'Truly I tell you, no prophet is accepted in the prophet's hometown. But the truth is, there are many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a severe famine over all the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them, except to a widow at Zarephath in Sidon. There were also many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian." When they heard this, all the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up, drove him out of the town, and led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they might hurl him off the cliff. But he passed through the midst of them and went on his way. This is the good news. When you just heard Paul read those familiar verses from our first scripture passage, the first thing you might have thought was, "Wait, there's a wedding today?" And then you may have looked around the sanctuary in search of flowers and rental clothing, clip-on bow ties, and bridesmaids' dresses. I hope you weren't too disappointed when you didn't find any of that stuff. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but no one's getting married at HUCC this morning. Believe me, if they were, I'd probably know. It would be totally understandable if you jumped at that conclusion, though. Because if you've ever been to a wedding where the liturgy was even remotely Christian, then there's a better than average chance that this was one of the readings that you heard there. It's definitely one of the New Testament's most memorable passages. In fact, people typically recognize it, even if they can't actually tell you the book of the Bible from which it comes. The answer, of course, is 1 Corinthians. Try to remember that so you can dazzle your fellow wedding guests with your knowledge at some point in the future. I must say that I've always enjoyed hearing Paul's poem about love at weddings. And now, since I've gone pro, I really like reading it at weddings too. For starters, it's beautifully written. And because Paul mentions the word love 9 times in 13 lines, and then uses the word it to refer to love another 4 times, it seems to be a perfect choice for celebrating the beginning of a marriage. But I have to be completely honest with you. This passage was never intended by Paul to be used at weddings. And it's not really about marriage. Sure, we may hear it now 2,000 years later and picture two people gazing into each other's eyes, testifying to the connection they feel to each other, and proclaiming how patient and kind and endless their love for one another is. And that's wonderful. But that's not even close to being the context in which Paul was writing. Like most of Paul's other letters, this one was written to an individual community to address specific issues at a particular time. Paul typically reaches out to churches because they're having problems, ones they're not handling particularly well on their own. And the Corinthians are no exception to this rule. Paul isn't congratulating the Corinthians for the great love they've been showing toward one another. He's actually chastising them for doing the exact opposite. In other words, love is patient and love is kind, but they are not. Love is not envious or arrogant or rude, but they are. Love does not insist on its own way, but they do. You get the picture. And trust me, the Corinthians did too. They would have understood exactly what Paul was saying to them, and they wouldn't have been too happy to hear all of these horrible things about themselves. I mean, if you asked them, they probably would have told you that they were doing a pretty great job of being a church. After all, they're willing to give away what they have. At least a few of them have prophetic powers. Heck, some of them are even able to speak in tongues. And that's pretty cool. But Paul doesn't care about this kind of stuff because God doesn't care about this kind of stuff. These are earthly things, human things, that will inevitably go by the wayside at some point, as all earthly things do. They simply won't last. And they just don't matter. Love, however, is an entirely different story. It's the one thing that does matter. Unless you've been living under a rock for your entire life, you've heard it before. Love makes the world go round. All you need is love. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. And it's the one thing that will actually last. As Paul himself tells us at the end of the passage, love never ends. And yet, as important as love is, Paul doesn't ever actually explain what love means. Oh, he definitely talks his way around it a bunch. Love is a lot of things. Essential, patient, kind, believing, hopeful, enduring. And love is not a bunch of other things. Envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude. And yet, we don't actually ever get a definition of love from Paul. It's just one of those things that we must, at least for now, see in a mirror dimly. Or if you prefer the King James Version, through a glass darkly. But how we actually understand this word love has tremendous implications for interpreting what this passage is saying, not only to Paul's original readers in the first century, but also to readers in every time, including us in ours. At this point, it might be helpful for us to jump back into the King James Version for a minute. The King James Version translates the word we see rendered in our pew Bibles as love a bit differently. There, the word isn't love. It's charity. We need to remember that the entire New Testament was originally written in Greek, and the translation into English in honor of King James was done over a millennium and a half later, in the 17th century. Because that was a long, long time ago for us, some modern readers find the words of the King James a little too old-fashioned for their liking, and I get that. Spake instead of spoke, thou instead of you, leadeth instead of lead, can sound odd to 21st century ears. But with respect to this particular word, the Greek word agape, the King James seems to be on to something pretty revolutionary here, and it invites us to look at this passage very differently. We tend to think of charity these days as being a mere handout, something that is dispensed quite literally with hand out. And by this I don't mean the recipient awaiting alms with open palms. I mean the giver remaining at arm's length and never getting too close. But in the 17th century, charity was thought of very differently. It was quite literally the act of doing good for someone else. Charity, in this sense, is more a leveling of the playing field between people than it is a handout to someone from someone else who is understood to be their better. Charity, in this sense, is an expression of the idea that the giver and the recipient are more alike, more equal, than either of them may have previously realized. It is the seemingly lovely reminding the seemingly unlovely that they are in fact lovely, that they are worthy of love, just because they are. And this is what Paul was getting on the Corinthians' case for here, for thinking that they were better than other people, or looked at from the other direction, for thinking that other people are somehow inferior to them. If I give away all my possessions but do not have love, I gain nothing. Call it love, call it charity, call it whatever the heck you want. For Paul, the implications are pretty clear. Give away all the money and stuff you want, but if you don't actually see the recipient as your equal, then you're missing the whole point of what it is to follow Christ. If you disagree with someone and allow that disagreement to divide you, then you're missing the whole point of what it means to follow Christ. If you don't recognize your common lot with everyone else here with you on God's green earth, then you're missing the whole point of what it means to follow Christ. As I said earlier, despite the fact that Paul didn't write this letter to address marriage, I really do believe that this passage is well suited for weddings. And I believe this because two people who have chosen to spend the rest of their lives together probably ought to understand from the outset what love calls them to do and how love calls them to act, because they are, at the end of the day, equals in relationship. But what about all those other people out there, the ones you haven't made the choice to spend the rest of your life with, the ones you don't seem to have much in common with, the ones who are difficult for whatever reason for us to be around? What about them? Paul's whole point is that we are equals too, that we are called to love them too, even when that proves to be challenging, even when that stretches our capacity to love to what seems like a breaking point. It's worth noting that for all the things Paul does say about love, he never says that love is either easy or particularly enjoyable. And so the next time you hear this passage read at a wedding, try to remember that it doesn't simply apply to the relationship between those two people on that specific day. It applies to all of our relationships for our entire lives. And for that, thanks be to God.